As we just heard, students face huge challenges in managing debt. In the U.S., student loan debt surpassed credit card debt last year. This year, it's projected to exceed $1 trillion. Steve Inskeep spoke with Mark Kantrowitz, as publisher of FinAid.org and FastWeb.com. He writes about the choices students need to make before they enter college.
So is all of this borrowing for college smart?
Well, it's smart if it's enabling you to invest in your future. It's not smart if you're overborrowing for the value of that investment.
Overborrowing? So
if you borrow more than your expected starting salary after you graduate, you're going to struggle to repay your loans. And I can see someone borrowing perhaps $10,000 a year if they're majoring in computer science or nursing, but I can't see borrowing that amount of money for a degree in art or humanities or sociology, because the jobs just don't pay as well for those fields of study.
What are some of the most, let's say, the hardest degrees to monetize later on?
Some of the most common majors for students who are having trouble are degrees in religious studies, in theater. Ethnomusicology is one that I've written about, where I got a call and an email from a student who was contemplating borrowing six figures of debt to pay for that degree.
Ethnomusicology. I mean, that's the study of music, but also of the society behind, the culture behind the music. Is that right?
That's right. And there are only two main occupations for a degree in ethnomusicology. One is being a music librarian, which doesn't pay very well. The other is being a university faculty teaching other students about ethnomusicology.
If you're having to borrow that $10,000 per year, you got to multiply that by 4 years, maybe more. You should hope that the field that you're heading into has a starting salary of at least that much.
That's right. And if you're going to be borrowing more than that, you should look for a less expensive college. Or maybe you should double major in a field that will enable you to repay that debt.
So you're not saying don't become an ethnomusicologist. You are saying do it in a smart way so that you don't get in trouble later on.
That's right. I'd be the last person to tell a student not to follow their dreams. You just need to have that kind of conversation before you incur the debt.
Mark Kantrowitz is the publisher of FinAid.org and FastWeb.com. He's speaking from member station WQED in Pittsburgh. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
And our series Money Counts continues all week. We'll hear about a program in Virginia that teaches middle school students the value of a buck. There's more on our series at our website, npr.org.
Now, people who live along the Mississippi floodplain talk about two catastrophic years, 1927 and 1993, and 2011 is shaping up to rival those years. In 1993, 50,000 buildings in the Midwest were destroyed, 74,000 people displaced. And that year, a reporter named Isabel Wilkerson would go on to win the Pulitzer Prize for her coverage of those floods in the New York Times. Here's a passage from her groundbreaking reporting.
Unlike a hurricane that strikes swiftly and moves on, or an earthquake from a distant epicenter, or fires with no name or permanent residence, the source of a flood is usually a relative with whom one must make peace after the temper tantrum is over. For the Midwest, emerging from the worst flooding in the country's history, that means relearning and coming to terms with the Mississippi River, a rowdy uncle who gives freely in good times and breaks the furniture in bad and pretends not to notice after the damage has been done.
When I spoke with Isabel Wilkerson a short time ago, she described what it was like back then.
I had a chance to see the power of water, water that essentially is returning to its home place, which we as humans don't see because we have managed to control it and keep it in a tight channel that never was really where it was supposed to be. It's humbling to see exactly what can happen when water takes back the places that it had been in before.
Isabel, for those who don't live in the area, I just want to give folks a sense of scale, because I think in 1993, the area that was flooded, that was underwater, was, I think, the size of Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island combined, and maybe even larger than that area. It was an enormous area. There was a lot of news coverage of that story. It seems that with this one, it's different. And I wonder whether you've noticed that, too, and why you think that might be.
Well, the floods of 1993 were primarily upper Mississippi River Valley. It was the entire Midwest, essentially, was affected by this. This particular flood that we're looking at now is one that's a southern experience. It's one that's from primarily Arkansas and Missouri south. And that has additional symbolic meaning because that is where the 1927 flood was based. And also, this is a region of the country that has had so much stress upon it overall, from Katrina to the oil spill and now this. There's just a tremendous sense of, I believe, heartache that is being experienced there and by all Americans as we look upon this part of the region, a part of the country that is yet again experiencing this kind of tumult.
In 1993, in your reporting for the New York Times, you described the Mississippi River as a rowdy uncle who gives freely in good times and breaks the furniture in bad times.
It's a part of the family, in a way. It's where the people live. It's an extension of their lives. It is the basis of their lives in many respects. I mean, many people are farmers or they are related to agricultural businesses that were the basis of the towns and the cities that we now see as St. Louis or Des Moines or Alton, Illinois. And I think I learned so much from the people who had gone through this before because they accepted this as a natural part of what life was like, and it was in some ways an extension of their own existence.
Is this strange for you to watch? I mean, this was such a big part of your life. Is there kind of a sense of deja vu?
Oh, absolutely. When I look at the photographs, you almost don't know what year you're looking at. Is it 1927? Is it 1937? Is it 1993, 2011? Which one is it? I mean, when you see large expanses of water and the shell of a rooftop peeking above it, that shows you that this is a universal human experience that transcends a particular year, a particular state. It is merely something that has to be contended with by human beings who have to find a way to live with this force of nature that even with all of our technology has not figured out a way to tame.
That's Pulitzer Prize-winning author Isabel Wilkerson. She covered the 1993 floods for the New York Times and is the author of the book The Warmth of Other Suns. She joined me from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Isabel, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Lord, 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 I'm so blue. My house got washed away, and I'm crying how long for another payday. That's why I'm crying, Mississippi heavy water blue. I'm sitting here looking at all of this mud, and my gal got washed away in that Mississippi.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
While some big money is getting into higher education, more than a million students will be getting out this spring with bachelor's degrees. And the job outlook is better than it's been for some time. But, as NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports, how well many of these new grads do will depend largely on what they studied.
Students at cafes and study halls on the University of Washington campus often tell two very different stories about their quest for a job after graduation. Many liberal arts and social science majors are pounding the pavement, but students in computer science, engineering, and other technical fields are in high demand. Brittany Kohler, for example, could practically write her own ticket. Her major is industrial and systems engineering.
The job market for graduating seniors in industrial engineering right now is actually very promising. The field itself is really growing, moving outside of just manufacturing, which is what it used to be, into healthcare systems, into businesses.
Kohler plans to do systems integration work for a global consulting firm. She'll be making nearly $70,000 a year. She turned down a job paying even more.
Not to sound boastful, but every single job I applied for, I got an interview for and got an offer. So it was exciting for me.
Another engineering student, Nick Douglas, had more than one offer, too. He's taken a job at Cisco Systems.
They're looking for electrical engineers, computer scientists who wanted to do something like on the people side a little bit more, and that's exactly what I wanted to do.
You happy with the salary you're getting?
Very happy. I feel very comfortable that I will be able to support myself without my parents' help from here on out.
nationwide employers surveyed by the National Association of Colleges and Employers said they expected hiring of college grads to be up nearly 20% over last year. It's a huge increase, though remember, 2010 was hardly a banner year. One employer who's hiring lots of new grads is Verizon. At the giant wireless communications company, new graduates might work in a customer service office like this one in suburban Seattle or at a retail store. Chad Keener is a company recruiter.
The qualities that we're really looking for is somebody who's ambitious, somebody who's really looking for a career. You know, we want somebody that's interested in growing themselves and then tech savvy.
He says the company aggressively promotes from within, so entry-level jobs can pretty quickly turn into something more. But back on the University of Washington campus, international relations student Sharmila Ejmera remains discouraged. She sees her friends struggling to find work, so the survey data showing the job market is improving doesn't mean much to her.
It used to be that you go to college and you're sort of promised a job. You get that BA or BS and you're good to go. And anymore, it doesn't feel like that. It feels like you need to work a lot harder, get more experience, get more education possibly. So, yeah, the numbers really, they don't speak to me.
One new challenge facing social science grads is that while private employers have been adding jobs, positions in government and social services that they might have applied for are being cut. Senior Kelsey Barrett says some of her recently graduated friends have ended up working as baristas or in retail sales.
Trying to make money so that they have time on the side maybe to volunteer and get experience so that in the next year or two they might be more competitive for this difficult job market.
Indeed, Barrett, another international relations major, is putting off her search for a full-time job. For the next few months, she intends to work part-time, improve her foreign language skills, perhaps take an internship, and come January, work with a nonprofit in Africa. She wouldn't be getting a salary, but she would get room and board, plus resume-boosting experience. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
Some other cities are responding to their financial troubles by outsourcing public services. One is Half Moon Bay, a seaside town south of San Francisco that's turned over some government functions to neighboring communities. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Police Chief Lee Violette heads down the narrow corridor of the small prefab building that houses the Half Moon Bay Police Department.
We actually use this also as our DOC, Emergency Operations Center, property evidence room down there, Detective Bureau. We have no Detective Bureau. That was one of the positions that was eliminated 2 years ago.
The department has been laying people off for some time. Within months, it will shut down altogether, and the San Mateo County Sheriff's Office will take over law enforcement in the town.
In my 38 years of police work, this is the first department that I've been involved in where we're actually looking at terminating the Half Moon Bay Police Department as a municipal entity.
The town is also outsourcing its Parks and Recreation Department to a neighboring community, and city officials say more cuts could come. Half Moon Bay's troubles began when it was sued by a developer who'd been denied the right to build a subdivision. A judge awarded him $38 million, so this town of 13,000 people has to spend more than $1 million a year, one-sixth its current budget, paying off the judgment. To pay the cost, the town had to begin laying off employees, says Mayor Naomi Patridge.
The first major cut was devastating for everybody, but we thought, okay, we can handle this. And then as time went on, the economics got very, very bad.
Half Moon Bay depends heavily on tourism, and as the recession took hold, hotel and sales tax revenues fell sharply. To fill the budget gap, the city council asked residents last November to approve a 1% increase in the local sales tax.
I said, what are these people, nuts? Who's going to vote for any kind of a tax increase in this environment?
Charles Nelson, who owns a cooking store on Main Street called Toque Blanche, says if the measure had passed, the local sales tax would have exceeded 10%.
So I didn't want people, when they think of Half Moon Bay, to think of high sales tax. That I didn't see how that would be good for business. And if it wasn't good for business, ultimately it wouldn't bring in the revenues that the city needed.
Some people in town supported the tax increase, people like longtime resident Bill Bakalenikov. He says the extra taxes are a small price to pay to keep the town going.
Nobody likes to pay taxes, but then again, if you want city services, you want to have a smooth-running community, you got to pay it.
But the tax increase was ultimately defeated, and since then, the city has had to slash government services. More than half of the city's employees have been laid off. City officials are trying to put the best face on what's happened. Police Chief Violette says the cuts have been so severe that the local police force was probably no longer viable as an independent department. There's not enough money for training or adequate staffing. So he says turning over policing duties to the county sheriff probably makes the most sense.
Well, I think what you're seeing here is probably long overdue. I think a lot of people in Half Moon Bay would have said, you know, maybe we should have looked more closely at this a year or two ago and we would have been ahead a little bit.
Many longtime residents say something will be lost in Half Moon Bay when the police force is disbanded. But at a time when budgets are so tight, many local services may be a luxury that the city can no longer afford. Jim Zeroli, NPR News.